Please welcome for his lecture the other half of the soundscape, oral architecture, Dr. Barry Blesser.
It is a great honor to be here, and I'm not capable of presenting sitting down, so I have a portable mic. I'd like to give you a little background as to where this whole topic came from. Having spent 40 years in the audio industry as acoustics, product development, I came to realize a few years ago that I didn't actually understand sound. Now, one might ask, how can one work in a profession that's preoccupied with sound and not understand it? And then I took a 2-year vacation where I began to research all those aspects of sound that I didn't understand. And I'll put out a plug, a recommendation, that there's a vast quantity of knowledge in fields related to ours, but don't recognize they're related to ours. And so I spent 2 years trying to take all the intellectual bricks that I could find in all the other disciplines and to build a complete structure. The structure I ended up building has the title Oral Architecture. And since the book came out, I've had large numbers of dialogues and discussions with people, and I've been continually extending the premise that the book is built on. And this is part of it. When I wrote the paper for the proceedings for this conference, maybe a month ago, even in the month, my thinking has evolved. And so what I'm going to present is both a summary of the last 10 years of my thinking, as well as some of my newer thoughts, perhaps to open up a dialogue. And if we have time during the coffee break, we can conduct our own seminar. So why don't we begin with the premise that maybe we don't completely understand sound. This particular talk is based on the question, where are you? Now, the question, where are you, should be obvious. We all know where we are. But if you really sort of delve into the question, you may not know where you are. The soundscape contributes to your sense of location. It tells you where you are. But these words don't really mean very much until we examine them. So if I were to say, where are you, everyone in this room would give a very clear answer as to where you are. And I might push you and say, well, how do you know where you are? You know where you are because of your senses. Each sense makes a contribution. You can hear, you can see, you can smell, you can touch. The senses complement each other. And if you were to describe where you are, you would describe it in terms of geometry, of events, location, objects. And this is a question that exists in some disciplines, some of the philosophy disciplines, some of the anthropology disciplines. And the sense of where you are is not obvious. It doesn't come from your biology. And different cultures have different ways of answering the question. Let me explore this a little bit. Because one of the questions that I did find answers to is, what does it mean to use your senses? Everybody in this room thinks of hearing and their sense of sound as very clear. But let's first step back and look at all the senses. Well, there are different cultures that have different attitudes, which means our culture has an attitude which comes from the culture, not from biology, not from truth. It's simply we were taught to think a certain way. But there are other ways of thinking. There's an ancient tribe in Africa called the Hausa people, and they have only two senses. And their concept of the sense is very curious. They have the sense of seeing and the sense of experiencing life. And in experiencing life is what you might call hearing, intuition, memory. And they pull out seeing and vision as being a secondary sense, which is sort of ancillary, and it's only for one purpose in these people. It's to avoid walking into a tree. The other senses are much more experiential. There is a research group, I believe it's in Toronto, but I'm not sure, by David Howes, who has sensory anthropology. And you might ask, well, why would one have sensory anthropology? And he has been studying the whole concept of the senses as an experiential part of life, again, which is not consistent. Now, let me give you a politically incorrect research program that was done in the 50s, and it's been lost. There's a lot of intellectual insights that have been lost in the libraries because they have not been built on. And I saw my job in researching this is to pull out all these bricks of intellectual knowledge and to build a structure. The one I'm going to share with you now is sensory deprivation. And this was done in the 50s. I believe, again, it was in a Canadian university. It might have been Montreal. I had a late colleague who was involved in some of these studies. And they took subjects, students, and they put them in a sensory deprivation tank where they couldn't touch, they couldn't hear, they couldn't see, they couldn't smell. They were completely cut off from the world. The results of this experiment were quite profound and tell us a lot now. Within 20 minutes, most of these students were hallucinating, and within 45 minutes approximately, they had lost their mind. They showed symptoms of psychosis and schizophrenia, and some of them never recovered. Okay, now, the point of this, they never continued this research, obviously. But what does this mean? And the implications are very profound, because it says while we think of ourselves as an individual, we cannot exist separate from the world of people and objects. Our brains must be connected. And so one of the themes that comes out of this is connection. You must, to keep your mental stability, be connected through your senses to the physical world, the social world, the psychological world, and any severing of these connections produces emotional disruption. There was another study in the 1950s, in England done by a geriatric medical community that showed that 50% of the mental distress in the elderly could be explained by unrecognized hearing loss. And the final little anecdote I'll share with you, which again is not politically correct, that those disability workers who work with patients who have either lost their hearing or their vision will tell you unambiguously, if you lose your vision, you may walk into a wall, but your emotional, psychological health remains completely intact and identical to those who haven't got this disability. They will also tell you that if you lose your hearing, the burden of emotional stability is dramatically elevated. It is very hard without hearing to maintain your connections to the world. Now, that should tell us something about sound, or tell us something about hearing. So let us continue with our exploration of things we didn't realize. Okay, so we're going to reconsider sound and hearing. And we're going to start from the premise that we don't actually understand it. And so let's look at some of the properties. Well, sound is unique. It flows around obstacles. It flows into openings. It reveals the interior state. If I knock on this table, you can hear properties of the table, even though you can't see those properties. It contains time. You have a sequence of events that take place. Vision doesn't do a great job with time. It's used for broadcasting over large distances. It can be cut up into smaller channels, and the cutting up of sound can be done on time. I speak now, an hour later somebody else speaks. It can be cut up into frequencies. Somebody uses high frequencies, another uses low. You can use directionality sharing. And many species understand the sharing of the sound medium. And most importantly, from my perception, there's no private space. Sound connects things together even though it's not supposed to, because sound has its own properties. But the stress, the idea that I want to stress is number three on this list. You cannot have sound without an energy event to create it. There's no such thing as a static world that creates sound. My voice is taking biologic energy to make my vocal cords vibrate, and that is creating sound. If I hit the table, I'm taking muscular energy. If you get a thunderstorm, nature has created electric energy, which then gets converted to sound. So sound, by its definition, is an energy process. Now, notice there's a contrast that's not necessarily true of vision, because you have the sun or some light source illuminating a static world. The world can be without any energy source or any activity. In fact, almost every book on architecture will show pictures of buildings and constructs and cities without people. You don't need people to see an environment. Now, let's keep going with the uniqueness of hearing. If I were to ask the average person on the street, which would you be willing to lose, hearing or vision, they would say, I could never do without vision. And why do they think that? Well, maybe perhaps because they think hearing is for the purpose of listening to music on your headphones or listening to language. And with the advent of computers and text messaging, they say, we don't even need that. That may be true among certain subcultures, but it's certainly not true from an evolutionary point of view. And I will urge those of you who care to start looking at the cognitive science literature, especially the neurobiology literature, because a lot of the folk wisdom that's been accumulated over the years is now finding support in the research of how the brain works. And I love it because my intuitions are being validated. Maybe yours will also. But they are actually understanding more and more how the brain works, and not in the wiring sense, in the sense that this thing is wired to this, but properties of the wiring. So that, for example, we now understand that consciousness is only one small piece of brain substrate that can report on certain experiences in a few other substrates, like the dashboard in a car. You can't recognize all kinds of other dynamics that are going on. And furthermore, you're not a holistic self. You're a bunch of independent brain substrates which are connected, but those connections are somewhat fragile, unreliable, and the communication between one part of my head and another is subject to noise, errors, inconsistencies, in the same way that two people may not agree. Okay, so we now have an evolutionary point of view. The hearing system, which is wired in deep and uses a fair amount of cortical resources, had to have value, because one of the properties of your brain material, it was a scarce resource. And at least in human beings, there was the optimization of, if you don't use it, it will get reallocated to something else. And so one has to ask, why would nature have given so much material to the auditory cortex, wired it in so deep, unless it had survival value? And the answer is, it really did have a large amount of survival value. We build upon that. And one of the things we notice is those who are interested in the sonic arts and music are actually building on these substrates and borrowing them for completely different purposes. They were not designed for music. They were not designed for what we use them now. And they have properties which artists will find useful. They were designed to keep you alive. In the same way, nature saw no value in giving you the ability to describe what you were hearing. She didn't give you the ability to turn a description of the spectrum of a sound source into language. Language is vastly overrated. It's not very good. It happens to be the best we have for communicating with each other, but we have to be humble enough to recognize it has very severe limits. Language simply is weak. Now, another part of the auditory cortex, especially among some species, which we know of from dolphins and bats, they can do what's called echolocation, where they can navigate entirely with their ears. But what's less well known is that there are a large number of species, including humans, that have auditory spatial awareness as part of their auditory cortex. They can, in fact, navigate entirely with their ears. It takes some practice. All of us can do it to some extent. Those that really care can develop their brain cortex areas to be able to do this quite well. And there are about at least a dozen species that have already been identified as being able to navigate entirely through their ears. If you then go back and look at hearing and vision is very good in one narrow area, your point of focus. And nature intended this to be a high accuracy region, but she gave you no mechanism to tell you where to look. I can look anywhere I want, but unless I'm a television scanning system, I have no idea where to look. She wired in the auditory system to tell the visual system where to look. So already you begin to see the audio system is kind of the master control for where interesting things are happening. If they're happening over there, I may want to look there, but it's the audio system that tells me that. Because this is so critical, nature gave us no ear lids. And in the case of primates, she gave us no ability to even steer our ears the way a cat could do that. Simply, it's a 24/7, always-on system, always running. And in the middle of the night, a mother can hear the baby cry, or you can hear sudden silence where you don't expect it, and wake up with a startle. This system is always running. The people who really understand this high-impact system are the people who do sound editing for the cinema, because they're in the business of trying to produce high impact. And they are exploring the impact of sound, not the aesthetics, not the musical arts. They are basically trying to draw upon their understanding of what sound really means. Now, with this construct that I've outlined, let's take another framework for the soundscape. And I had an interesting insight the other day in looking at the parallel between a soundscape and a landscape. If you analyze the words, you notice they're not at all symmetric. You don't call it a lightscape, but you call it a soundscape. And yet sound has a very weak language system associated with it. So what is it that is the soundscape? The landscape, and I'm using landscape in a much more general sense, to be objects and geometries that you can see. And so I'm going to try to understand what a soundscape really is. It's a transport of events. And this event that takes place is then broadcast over a large area. So sound is a transport mechanism. It's nature's first broadcast system. And in fact, there are a large number of historic examples, which I mention in the book, more I've accumulated, where sound was explicitly an event broadcaster. And it was obvious to them that that's what sound was. Events compete for your attention. And so when you say, what is a soundscape, it's events taking place in the world, each of which are broadcasting their existence to anybody in the space that can hear them. I'm not sure if we have working audio, but if we do, I'm going to play you this clip. And the purpose of this is to give you a clear sense of events. Okay, you heard of those. Those are trivial. Every one of you has heard those and many more. But notice if I ask you to describe what you heard. You might try to describe some property of the bell, maybe its resonant frequency. You certainly would have a lot of trouble telling me anything about the baby in terms of sound. But if you had any literary imaginative proclivity, you could write a short story about any one of those events. You could describe the baby's stress and distress, its relationship to its mother. The car horn gave you the sense of somebody who was impatient, who was trying to signal somebody and broadcast his urgency at getting through. You could write a complete story about every one of those sounds. But I challenge any one of you to write a complete description of the sound itself. And I've never had anybody who could do that. We're not designed to do that. We can measure things in the laboratory, and I'm the first quintessential engineer who could measure everything about those sounds. But I would learn nothing about my measurements other than physical measurements. Okay, let's continue. So I'm going to now introduce a new framework to put on top of the existing framework. The soundscape framework was created in the 70s and was brilliant. And I'm going to try to explore the question of what happens if we push the framework to the next level up. And so I'm going to redefine soundscape as an eventscape. And I will just read it to you because you got to think about it for a while to get its implications. An oral event is a natural, intentional, or accidental conversion of mechanical energy into sound. And that is broadcast to the inhabitants. So when we talk of a soundscape, that's what we're really talking about. And the eventscape, I had to create words in dealing with all this because language is kind of difficult and imperfect. And rather than overloading words, which is another interesting discussion, you have a choice of redefining existing words or inventing new ones. I should do a footnote. On my website, one of my pages, I collect really interesting books, and one of them is on language. And these are books that just fundamentally changed how I think. And for those of you who care, I'll give you some little card that how to get to my website. An eventscape is a composite of temporal and spatial distributed events which are transported to the listeners. Now, this framework explains, for me anyhow, a lot more of history, a lot more of current events. It explains the iPod generation. It explains all kinds of ideas and phenomenon that I wouldn't have been able to explain otherwise. And so at least for me, I like this framework because of its predictive value. Let's go back to the central thesis about place. Where are you? And I'm going to define two frameworks for where you are. And there are exceptions, but let's just start from this premise. You're in a static object landscape. And I'm not using landscape in the sense of trees or vegetation. I'm using landscape in the sense of a static world out there with objects, their location, their geometries. That's gives you a clear sense of where you are. But there's a second answer to the question, where are you? You're in the midst of dynamic activities in the eventscape. Now, of these two systems and frameworks, which do you think nature thought was more important? Well, in fact, she thought dynamic activities were far more important, and for many species, especially the more primitive ones, they can't see anything static. They can only see movement. And our visual system, curiously enough, inherited that property. You can't see static images. But nature said, you know what, for humans, I'm going to compromise this a little bit. And so what she did is she wired in staccatic movement of your eyes. And so in order to keep the image on your retina from being static, she made your eyes wiggle around. And you can't stop this from happening. If you, in fact, glue a camera to your eye, which they can do in the medical context, such that these movements do not shift the image disappears. So even in our fundamental structure, we want to relate to changes because from a survival danger point of view, the static world was rarely ever threatening, except perhaps for walking off a cliff or into a tree. A static world doesn't come grab you and make you lunch. A static world does not offer you lunch. Now, if you then look at hearing and seeing, predominantly but not exclusively, seeing is for the static world and hearing is for the eventscape. There are exceptions. Obviously, we can see movement. I can see people walking around, but it's not particularly good at it. Similarly, I can create an image of the space with a little more training such that I can visualize the static world just by how the background sound is affected. And it's called echolocation in humans, but it's the wrong word. And for those people who've seen the movie or read the book Ray Charles or have read some of the philosophy in Diderot and others, or in the 30s this was a big issue, there are people who got very good at essentially imaging the world through their ears. And there was one study in the 50s where one exceptional person could identify the traffic sign shape at 10 meters by its acoustic signature. So he could walk around and say, there's a stop sign. What these people were doing is training themselves, because they were motivated to do so, and hijacking brain substrates, which we called part of the visual system but weren't. They were actually the spatial organizational system. And they just got very, very good at it. Another part of this discovery, I'm going to run out of time, but it's part of we have a half an hour break so we can spill over, is cultural acoustics. You are how you live. your brains are not generic. You live a certain way, it changes your brain. And you have no choice. So that, for example, conductors have different localization ability. Blind people who use the cane have a different organizational system than blind people who don't. At one point, I was the world's most acute listener of reverberation tales. I could hear things in those reverberation tales that probably nobody else in the universe could hear. I lost that ability because I stopped using it. And so the notion that there's a generic human being is simply wrong. That's another digression. Okay, now how are you going to evaluate a soundscape or the eventscape? Each listener uses a unique criterion. A sonic event may be pleasing or distracting, helpful or irrelevant, comforting or threatening. This is a season to taste. It's like music. Why should I want to be connected to a particular event? Well, I may want to be, or I may not want to be. I may enjoy the intensity of New York City traffic, or I may not enjoy it. I may feel it energizes me, or I may feel it's debilitating and exhausting. Everybody has their own preference. Everybody has their own preference in cheese, in wine. Why shouldn't we have preferences in the eventscape? Assuming we do have personal preferences, that now leads to oral combat and sonic niches. And again, there's a vast literature which says the eventscape is a shared resource, and we have combat. Each species, each culture, each subculture has their own idea of what they want to do with it, and they fight over it. In some parts of the world, the species have learned to cooperate, but by and large, we do not have a history of cooperation over the soundscape or the eventscape. Emily Thompson catalogs this extensively. There is no cooperative mechanism, whether it's air or water or eventscapes. We simply are an animal designed to combat, and we do. You will take somebody who feels disenfranchised and helpless may very well ride his motorcycle through the streets at 3 in the morning. What he's engaging in is oral combat. He is saying, I want to control the eventscape. Certain religions have rules about the eventscape. And so the notion that we should preserve the good soundscapes or the good eventscapes is a political statement. They're not intrinsically good or bad. I have some very clear preferences. I love certain kinds of soundscapes, but I can't assume that you and everybody else will share this. And this is especially true for the new generation of young people who grew up in a different world. I should do a footnote. The generational cultural gap that we experience has a good reason for existing. Remember I said, you are how you live. Well, your parents lived in a decade or decades and developed certain kinds of cultural experiences. Their children grew up in different decades. Their brains are therefore wired differently with different proclivities. They didn't exist in the same world as their parents. This gives you generational combat, and we can get to that if we have time. The final piece of this is different kinds of experiences produce cognitive loading, arousal in the biologic sense, in the sense that the level of your brain activity can be elevated or decreased. This is biologically called arousal. And these are metrics which tell you how the human is experiencing his eventscape. There was a great study in Germany on the cognitive and biological loading in classrooms. And they actually went to the trouble of measuring physiologic symptoms like blood pressure, heart rate. There's just simply a large amount known which will make sense out of this. All right, I know I'm not going to have time for everything, but we still have some time. Now, how does this all relate to oral architecture? Now, oral architecture it's not acoustic architecture. Oral architecture is the way in which, I think I have a definition here, actually. Let's go to that. Okay, here's a definition. And my wife and co-author still debates with me whether we have the right definition or not. And so let's treat it as work in progress. The influence of passive objects, and what I mean by that is things that don't produce sound by themselves, and geometries on the emotions and behavior of the inhabitants, not the microphone. I don't care what it does to the microphone. I don't care what you can measure. How does it change your emotional and psychological state, your behavioral state? And it does. It's harder to characterize. It's part of sort of anthropology and phenomenology. And so the real question is, in an eventscape, how does the environment, the passive environment, change your behavior? And so we're going to look at that before we take some questions. And I came up with three distinct ways in which you can experience the oral architecture. And in this environment here, for example, the oral architecture are the walls, the materials of the surface. That's the physical description. But what is it doing to you? I could ask you, how connected are you to me? Because remember, the whole point of my talk is to connect one piece of my brain to one piece of your brain. So I would ask you, are you working hard to connect? Is it easy to connect? Are you distracted? Furthermore, depending on how I would design this space up here, I could increase my oral mass. I could, in the sort of emotional sense, appear bigger than life simply by coming up with structures behind me, entirely acoustic. I would modify the environment such that you would ask me a question from the audience and you would be low oral mass, I would be high oral mass, and we always know that the debate between the speaker on the podium and someone in the audience is an unfair battle, in part because the oral architecture of somebody sitting in the audience is fundamentally different than standing up here. I have emotional impact, and this is unconscious, although you can measure it. So here's the way in which the physical passive environment plays a dominant role in the eventscape. Well, the first thing it does is it divides the eventscape into separate independent regions. Now, the obvious division is a wall, that the people outside are separate from the eventscape in here. But there are other ways of separating it. If there was high background noise, what was said in here would not be audible here. If I move close to you, it would not be audible elsewhere. Birds are known to share the eventscape in terms of choosing different frequencies or different times of day. Dividing up the eventscape, it takes place all the time, and the physical environment can change how that division takes place. The next part of this is the oral architecture changes the oral character of the sounds themselves. You have never heard pure sound, and I always love these purists who say, I only want pure sound. And there was a movement in the 30s to only have pure sound. In fact, there is no such thing as pure sound. There's sound leaving my mouth and the sound entering your ears, but the transport process from my mouth to your ears involves a very complex situation where the sound is bouncing off the walls, it's being filtered, it's reflected, there may be reverberation, there may be interference, there may be echoes, there may be all kinds of things that have to take place. And those are changing your experience. The people in the back of the room, other than the loudspeakers sitting there, are fundamentally hearing something different than the people in the front. The environment is changing the sound as it's transported. There is no pure transport process. And finally, like a landscape, objects can be experienced when they're illuminated by sonic events. Yesterday I tried a little experiment in one of the workshops, but you can do it at home. Just, you can hear open doors, you can hear your footsteps on certain kinds of surfaces, you can hear low-hanging ceilings, you can hear the volume of air in your bathroom. You can, in fact, hear things that you're not aware of, but if the lights were suddenly to go out and you had to navigate to the bathroom, yeah, you might do it by touch, crawling to the bathroom, but you might also be able to do it by listening. You can hear all kinds of things, and I call that illuminating, I have to again borrow the word, sonic events. So these are the three primary ways in which the oral architecture influences the eventscape. All right, now, one of the other things I posted on my website is a very early, primitive, unfinished thing where I call it ear training for oral architecture. And if I ever get enough time, I will put more up, and I don't know if this audio is going to work given all the hum. But I wanted to illustrate some extreme spaces, and we'll see if this works. I don't know. Let's see. Okay, so let's just see if this...
There's a place for us.
Now, if I were to ask you, where is that singer, you could tell me an awful lot about where he was. You can hear the volume of the space. You can hear the distance from the microphone to him. You can describe all kinds of things, and with a little training, you could describe more. Now, the next one is one of my favorites because I was shocked at how much I had learned about this. This is taking place in Africa, and it was done by Bernie Krauser, who's been recording animals for years, and he had hours and hours up. Then I was listening to one. I said, wait a minute. That animal sound isn't right. And I'll play it for you. And this is a baboon. I gave you the answer. It's a particular species of baboon which loves to find reverberant caves to amplify their voice to broadcast over much larger distances. And I recognized that he was in a cave, even though he was far away. And again, I don't know. If you listen carefully to that baboon, you can hear the reverberation tail. There's no baboon that has that kind of vocal apparatus that can produce that nice smooth decay. He, as a species, was enhancing his eventscape by turning his vocal apparatus into an amplified big broadcast channel for whatever purposes. And these species all broadcast for a reason. They have their own culture, and they're also competing for the eventscape. Okay, now here I'm going to give you another example. This is a lunchtime. And just listen and tell me what you're hearing. Okay, I can't debate with all that, but if you were to listen with a little better quality and not in a space like this, what you would tell me is you're connected to lots of events in a busy pub. You could tell me what the pub's walls were made out of. You could tell me approximately the size of the pub. All of that would be registering unconsciously. You could be oblivious to it, and some of you might be, although I suspect in this room you're not. This is all taking place. Finally, I want to do a little ear training of a clapping hand, and again, I apologize for the acoustics. This is just a clapping hand sequence recorded dry in an anechoic chamber and then played back through a bunch of spaces. And I'm putting them together so you can hear the contrast, or you would. Let's see if I can. Okay, so let's. Just a quick introduction to the fact that you really can hear these spaces, and they really do change your experience. And depending on the space, if it's mismatched for the kind of events you want to connect to, it produces stress or other negativities. Okay, now if you're going to talk about oral architecture, we need a language. And I love to invent frameworks because I can't make sense out of other kinds of phenomena. In fact, I become a collector of data if I don't have a framework to file it away on. So in the process, I had to create a language of oral architecture. And these were the concepts I came up with. And again, I had to invent a word, which I call spatiality. Now, spatiality is the experience of a space, but not the space itself. It's what aspect of the space am I relating to or experiencing? And I've got five of them or six of them listed here. They kind of grow and shrink a little bit. I'll get into each one of them. So I could take this room and I can analyze it in terms of social spatiality, navigational, music, aesthetic, symbolic. And different people will be sensitive to different spatialities at different times. It may depend on their culture, their personality, the application, the situation. And I'm just going to introduce these. I got a few more minutes. Okay. But before I do that, I want to explain what spatiality is. This is a picture on Escher Reflections, and this is a picture. It's a visual equivalent of an environment, but if you look at that, you obviously know it's not a real environment. Yet it has all the attributes of a real environment. It's got doors, windows, it's got people, it's got staircases. So this picture has high degree of spatiality, but it's not a space. And so what I want you to start thinking about is oral spatiality, which is not a space. It could be, and you could connect it under some circumstances, but it's the experience of the space, not the space itself. And to take our highly rational culture and drag them out of their belief that there is a reality is not a trivial exercise. This would have not have been a problem 100 years ago, and it certainly wouldn't have been a problem 300 years ago. They just didn't know what rational physical reality is. Now we believe that's the only reality. In fact, it's not. Okay, social spatiality, which is probably the highest impact and certainly should be in the architectural world, you have oral boundaries, which I borrowed from Truax and Schaefer, acoustic arenas and horizons. These are regions of space where you can connect to sound. And these create boundaries. You can't touch them, you can't see them, but they create boundaries nevertheless. So an acoustic horizon, like the visual horizons, is the distance from your ears beyond which you can't hear any events. The acoustic arena is the area in which an event can be heard. It's sort of an eye-centric or an it-centric. And there are a whole group of examples which illustrate this. One of the ones, which is a whole book of French villages in the 19th century by Alan Corbain, and he describes that this entire village was structured around the sound of the bells. And if you couldn't hear the bells, you weren't part of the town. You didn't have citizenship. Connecting to the bells was total connection in terms of who you belonged to. And so the geography of these regions changed citizenship. If you had a long valley like an acoustic conduit, those people belonged to the town. But anybody who was just over the mountain where the mountain shadowed the bells was not part of the town. And he has numerous quotations showing how people responded to hearing the sound of the bells. This was broadcast. It broadcast time. It broadcast announcement. It broadcast emergencies. It broadcast all as well. Without these connections, you couldn't belong to the town. Dining at a restaurant is another classic example. Almost everybody I've talked to has been in a restaurant with horrible acoustics. Well, what does it mean to have horrible acoustics? And where does the issue come from? And so let me jump. I think I have it here. We have, in the 50s and 60s, Professor Hall came up with the concept of proxemetics, and he basically said social distance is not measured in meters and feet. It's measured in experience. So there's a distance where you would interact with some intimate member of your family or a lover. There's another distance which you might choose for a personal good friend. There's a colleague or somebody whom you're familiar with. And then there's something like here where I have a public distance. Now, if I invited one of you to sit up here, you'd be exquisitely uncomfortable because it's violating the expected distance of this particular venue. Now, this concept of social distance is critically important when we go back to the acoustic arena, because if you're going to have well-being, you want the acoustic arena and the social distance to match. And most of the stress in restaurants takes place when there's a mismatch between these two. It's not just the noise level. It's not just the physical acoustics. It's the mismatch. And so you take two business executives who are going to lunch, and in order for them to be comfortable, they want to be at a conversational distance of colleagues. And at that distance, it may be outside the acoustic arena. They can't hear each other. Now they're trapped. They cannot say anything. They can shout, or they can move too close for their relationship. You can get the same kind of thing in all these. So now you have an experiential framework. Okay, let me go back to this slide. This is a picture of Hogarth showing the enraged musician. And the important part of this picture is to look and say, how many spaces are involved in this picture? And almost everybody in the Western culture would say two. There's the musician's parlor, and there's the street. But from my perspective, there's only one space, because the acoustic arenas are so completely coupled. It's one oral space. There's no boundary at the window because it's open in the summer. And so you have private property colliding with a large acoustic arena. And there's no way out of this trap the moment you open the windows. And this illustrates the oral combat that was taking place in the 19th century. And again, if you really want to connect yourself to history, you have to read some of these discussions. The question was, who owned the eventscape? And the musician was saying, as upper class, I own it, be quiet. And the street musicians say, this is our home, our space. Tough, we're going to do what we want in our space. And there were laws, there were actually fights. There's a long history of combat over the eventscape because of not respecting these distances. All right, we're going to run out of air. Let's keep going. All right, navigational spatiality we've already alluded to. I am going to stop in a few minutes to take some questions. Actually, we have some break time after my presentation, so I was going to propose, if we want to kind of do an informal seminar for those that people want to hang around. Okay, you can hear objects and geometries. You can hear an open door. We went through this. Let's keep going. Now, this is an illustration. This is a group of blind bicycle teenagers riding their bikes in California. There's a teacher of the blind, Dan Kish, who himself was blind, taught himself to use his ears, and he wanted to teach other blind kids how to navigate entirely with their ears. And there's a long history of teaching the blind. Interestingly enough, the predictor of success is not enhanced acuity. These blind people, when studied, have the same hearing as you and I. It's basically devoting cognitive resources to it, and the critical predictor of people who learn this art is having parents who are willing for the children to take some risk. And that has a long history. If you throw yourself into it, you get better at it. If you hold back, you don't. You are how you live. Musical spatiality, I know that many people are involved in it. You can reduce the spatial experience of music to two dimensions and only two dimensions. Everything else is enhancements. You have what's called temporal spreading, that if you play a sound on a beach, the moment you stop playing, it dies. The space, at least in a concert hall, which has high spatiality for music, will extend the note with reverberation. That is a time change. You have another aspect of enclosed spaces, which is called spatial spreading. You will envelop the listener in a sea of sound. And the question really is, at least in the Western culture, why was reverberation in the spatial envelopment considered an attractive experience? And I can't prove the answer, but I came up with a consistent explanation. And that is, going back to the evolutionary discussion, we were designed to recognize the location of important events. And our ears, even without the flaps and the movement, does a very good job of localizing where an event is taking place. And almost every species has really decent localization. There are a few exceptions. If I'm in a reverberant process, it's one of the few experiences where I'm inside the process and there is no source of sound. I cannot tell you where reverberation is coming from because I'm in it. It's coming from every direction. And I call this experience oral caffeine. Our brain so wants to localize that it's a wake-up call. You're in trouble because you don't know where this sound is coming from. Of course, within a few hundred milliseconds, the brain relaxes and says, well, it's not dangerous. It's not somebody that's going to eat me for lunch. Nevertheless, enveloping sound is what I call oral caffeine. It produces a biological arousal wake-up, and that's primarily why we've grown to like it. And there's a whole other body of literature which talks about the emotions of hearing and why certain kinds of patterns will produce emotions. And again, various artists have taken advantage of this. This is Karl Stockhausen, I guess, in the 60s in the caves of Lebanon. And he chose this. Okay, he chose this space because of its unique acoustic properties. All right, we can sort of. All this stuff is on the web. I also bought 3 copies of the book for those that have trouble getting it. After the talk, I printed up little cards so you can get to the website. Everything on there is free to download. I welcome discussions. This is all work in progress, and I could go on for another 3 or 4 days, but I don't think you'd like that. It's hard to compress 10 years of work into 1 hour. And if anybody wants to buy a book at cost, I bought a couple copies. And anyway, there you go.
Thank you very much, Barry. I think we have about 5 minutes for general discussion here. We should keep some time for sorting out the technical problems in this room before the session starts in half an hour. Please take advantage of Barry and pick his brain as much as you can while you're here. This was really just skimming the surface, I tell you. There's a lot more in the book and in his brain. So perhaps we can take a few questions now.
Sus estudios están conectados de alguna manera con la creación de inteligencia artificial y cómo es posible que una máquina pueda oír toda la percepción espacial, la creación del sonido y la forma en cómo percibimos en un espacio.
Well, I used to be at MIT at the time when artificial intelligence was coming into vogue, and I'll share a politically incorrect view that at least our group had of it. We considered artificial intelligence, artificial minds creating artificial ideas. And the problem for us was, what is intelligence? And that actually has become an interesting subject, not in terms of artificial, but real intelligence. And like this study on oral architecture, when you really probe the question of what intelligence, you need much more sophisticated frameworks to make sense out of it. And so what's called artificial intelligence today is actually what's used to be called expert machines, in the sense that it's automating something that a human does and other humans figure out what the human does and then put that into an algorithmic structure to replicate a behavior. So one of the prime examples of artificial intelligence is an artificial doctor, and they get to that by discussing cases with hundreds and thousands of doctors and then statistically extracting the patterns. But in terms of artificial intelligence of space, what would constitute an answer? And how would I do that given your experience in the space and mine are totally different? Which of us has intelligence that we're duplicating?
Bueno, yo quería hacerle una pregunta personal. Y es, bueno, personal, no demasiado íntima, pero sí en relación a su historia personal con relación al mundo del sonido. Y lo que quería saber concretamente es qué efecto, qué influencia o qué importancia ha tenido para usted el concepto de paisaje sonoro en la evolución de este planteamiento, ¿no?, a lo largo de estos 10 años. Si fue algo que apareció de repente el concepto de paisaje sonoro y eso lo hizo cambiar, o ya tenía usted la idea y el concepto de paisaje sonoro le ayudó.
Well, that's a wonderful question. I have to tell you, the biggest influence in all my thinking came from having lived with my wife and co-author for 35 years. Because when we first married 1,000 years ago, I was the perfect engineer, believed in the physical world, and she was the perfect social scientist to believe in the soft world. And when you live with somebody, your brains connect, and now we've become kind of fused. And so the biggest impact for me was this cross-disciplinary fusion of two mentalities. And in another part of my evolution as a management consultant, I fundamentally believe that opposing ideas can and should be reconciled. And so I saw myself in doing the book in reconciling all these different perspectives. But to go back to the personal part of it, I hadn't realized that we played oral architect in the design of our home. And I don't mean design in the sense of large mechanical structures and so forth. We designed the rugs and the furniture and the doors to suit our needs and created an eventscape which matched our family's values. And so that was actually the first experience of manipulating a soundscape or an eventscape without realizing it. The other part, I didn't even know about this kind of acoustic ecology until I began my research. And that actually gets a personal note. How many of you can list at least a dozen other disciplines that have something to contribute to your understanding of sound, even though they don't advertise themselves as being interested in acoustic ecology? You could?
Sure.
Well, give it a whirl.
Cultural anthropology, human engineering. Human factors engineering, film, media studies. Yeah.
That's very good. In fact, there are a lot more that don't look like they have anything to say. One of my personal hobbies is epistemology. I don't know how it translates into Spanish, but at least in English, in this experiment, 90% of the graduate students that I've tested on do not know what the word means. How many have heard of it either in English or Spanish?
Of course.
Well, you're way ahead of my sample population. But that has a lot to say about what you're doing.
Well, Stephen Feld, the ethnomusicologist, started a discipline called acoustomology.
Yeah.
Basically the anthropology of sound and how we get a sense of place. Because it's sound that gives us a sense of place. Much
acoustic ecology is where are you? I do have three copies of the book. Who anybody who's having trouble getting it in their home country, I can sell it at cost. I'm happy to be available. We can run a seminar in the back of this room while they fiddle with the audio system, and I'll be around until Friday morning. Thank you very much.